there's this fundamental illusion. You think of yourself as a small object in space-time. That's what I am. I'm this 150-pound, 200-pound, whatever it might be, little object in space-time. And I'm only going to be here for a few years. I need to do whatever I can to try to complete myself and be special. And I need to compete with you. And it's an illusion. It's false.
This is the On Humans podcast with your host, Ilari Mäkelän. And today's conversation is a short one, but it's also a hefty one. We talk about everything from the meaning of life to the fate of the universe. My guest is Donald Hoffman, with whom I conversed already in episode 30. Now, don't worry if you have not listened to that already. I separated this exactly so that people could access the second section directly. After all, not everyone wants to hear about the mathematical ideas linking cognitive science with particle physics. Some of us do, I personally do. But I think that more of us are interested in hearing about novel ideas about the meaning of life and about the relationship between a scientific worldview and timeless spirituality. Indeed, Hoffman thinks that much of his thinking is resonant with old ideas in the great religions. But Hoffman is not a religious thinker as such. He is a mathematically sophisticated scientist who has a kind of theory of everything, everything from cosmos to consciousness. But it is a theory which makes space for religious ideas within a scientific worldview with much more ease than typical theories around modern physics. So Hoffman is a vision scientist. He used to work in the famous artificial intelligence lab of MIT in the 80s, teaching computers to see. But thinking about vision led him to ask the question, what does it really mean to see something? And he came to the following conclusion. To see something is to construct an icon. For example, when we see a red rose, we can ask, is the rose really red? It has a certain kind of surface. It's reflecting light in a certain kind of way. The redness is a creation of our mind. It's an icon for those wavelengths of light. But Hoffman asks us not to stop here. The redness is an icon inside our mind, but so is the shape of the flower. Indeed, for Hoffman, the very three-dimensional space moving forward in a one-dimensional time is but an interface. It's like a virtual reality headset that simplifies the mysterious reality into something tangible and easy for us to understand. The analogy here is like a computer screen. You can see that there's a two-dimensional trash can icon on your computer screen. It's pretty useful. You should probably pay attention to what you drag in there. But it's but an interface. And just in the same way as there is no real two-dimensional gray trash can inside the computer, there is no three-dimensional red rose hovering in the wind in the world out there. But this has a pretty dramatic conclusion. All three-dimensional objects, including my head and my brain, are inside my mind. What's fundamental is consciousness. Now, this is pretty wild, but what follows is extra wild. For Hoffman's team has really grabbed the bull by the horns here, and they have modeled this idea with precise mathematics. They have a formal model consisting of consciousness alone, just simple conscious experiences, from which space-time itself, with all the laws of physics, can emerge. And just this summer, they have actually started a project where they are trying to model precise findings in particle physics as emerging from their more fundamental model. Now, that is mind-bending stuff. If you're interested in those scientific details, do revisit episode 30. But what we discuss in this conversation is perhaps more important, which is, does this really matter? How should we live our lives differently? What could be the meaning of life in a world beyond space and time? Does God lurk behind Hoffman's equations? Let's hear it from Professor Hoffman himself.
The mathematics that we have starts off with these little conscious agents that have only one experience, say, you know, red or green or something. And we look at their interactions, and we start to build up. But that mathematics itself tells us that that approach is limited, because interacting conscious agents form new agents. And that means that we can have, if we start off with a countable set, a countable infinity of conscious agents, we can get a higher level infinity of their combinations. We take a bunch of them, have them interact. That combination is a new conscious agent. You get new levels of infinity. And so what we realize is our theory is telling us there's ultimately one big conscious agent, maybe.
There's one.
But you'd have to climb up all of Cantor's hierarchy and beyond to get to it. So we can't. But our theory points to it and says you'll never get there. So all right. So but that's what a good scientific theory does, right? A good scientific theory tells you its limits. Our theory says looks like there's one agent, and everything is a projection of that one agent, and you will never model that one agent. But you can model these projections and projections of projections. That's what you can do, and you can make testable stuff there, but you'll never get to the one. So that's where I am right now. Now, the question is, what can we say about the one?
Well, Kant would want you to say absolutely nothing except that we have more maybe reason for faith.
and Kant might be right.
The reason I said that, I mean, half a joke, but half to just point out that is a deeply, there's a deep spiritual potential.
Yes.
And if the term God comes to someone's mind, I don't think it's completely, ordinary.
Right. And I think that very spiritual traditions, I have a lot of interaction now with people from spiritual traditions because this part of the theory really sort of resonates with things they've been saying for thousands of years. And for what it's worth, my own guess right now is that you and I are the one, just using an avatar. So it's the one talking to itself through billions of human avatars and cat avatars and mouse avatars and tree and plant avatars. These are all just interfaces that the one is using to explore its potential. And I can't know the one in a conceptual sense, but I can know it directly because I am it. But now I've gone on that part. I've gone beyond my science. Where the science goes is all the finite collections of conscious agents and their properties and mapping into space time. That's the science. This other part is me reading the tea leaves of the math and saying, this is, Hoffman's best guess. And maybe it's also informed by what I've read in spiritual traditions and maybe don't take it too seriously, but that's, so I'm just putting out where I'm thinking about on that right now.
Are you religious?
I'm not practicing any particular, I don't attend or anything like that, but I meditate daily.
Can I ask what kind of tradition or what kind of technique?
The meditation is just going into pure silence. It's close to what some versions of Buddhist meditation techniques, they're very, very similar, of just silence and then returning to silence whenever thoughts or distractions occur. But I do it without any particular posture or no mantra or anything like that. It's just going back to silence. So I don't think I wouldn't say I'm any devotee of any particular religion. My dad was a Protestant fundamentalist Christian minister for a while, so I was raised in that, and I've read the Bible cover to cover more than once, so I know the Bible quite well, and I think that there are beautiful things in there. And there are also things that I disagree with. My guess is that science and spirituality will eventually seriously interact, because as we start to go outside of the space-time headset and let go of the scientific physicalism, and if the idea that conscious agents outside of space-time catches on, then we really will be using science to start to explore what spiritual traditions have been talking about for thousands of years. But the spiritual traditions, they've said for thousands of years that space-time isn't fundamental. There's something beyond space-time. But they haven't had the tools, the mathematical tools or the empirical tools. So science both brings something to the table. The spiritual traditions have thousands of years outside of space-time. They have a lot of insights. Science has been inside space-time studying the headset and has sharpened all these tools of mathematical theories and careful experiments. Yeah, it's going to be great. When we bring the two together, we will probably be able to learn from the insights of the spiritual traditions and also find where there's nonsense, right? There's nonsense in science. and there's nonsense in spiritual traditions. How do we find it out? Well, when we make our ideas precise enough to make them testable or to show that they're inconsistent or whatever. And I've enjoyed, I mean, I talk with spiritual teachers and so forth. Rupert Spira and I've had a couple of conversations.
Not really. I've actually met him in Oxford, yeah, when I was studying.
Yeah, no, yeah, I've met him too. I've met in San Jose a couple of times.
My father even went to one of his retreats, actually, in Italy.
Yeah, no, he's brilliant, and we enjoy talking with each other. It's just really quite nice. I had a conversation with the Dalai Lama back in 2017 or something like that, 2018, in Pisa, Italy, about science and spirituality. I'm good friends with Deepak Chopra, and I've also talked with a Jewish rabbi, Joseph Dweck, and I've talked with Islamic spiritual people as well. So I'm quite open to talking with various spiritual traditions with the same attitude that I have towards science, which is hard-nosed. I'm hard-nosed about the science. We're out here to learn. And I'm also hard-nosed about the spirituality. We don't want to fool ourselves. And it's very easy to fool ourselves. What science brings to the table is a precision of language that, in the best case, tells you the limits of your theory. That's what you want, is a theory that tells you your theory stops there. That's where your theory falls apart. And every theory will fall apart. When we just have language, which most spiritual traditions have, it's hard to find out the limits of your theory. Even though these spiritual traditions will say, these words are just pointers. Do you mean, this the pointer is not the way, the map is not the territory. They'll say that, but the followers don't really follow that. We end up with religious wars. We end up with dogmatism, fighting each other. And precision is a help, because when your own theory tells you, when Einstein's theory tells you, your theory stops at 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, what can you say? Yeah, my theory stops at 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, case closed. My theory doesn't go any further than that. Can't be dogmatic about space-time anymore. My own theory of space-time tells me not to be dogmatic about it. And that's what we need in the spiritual traditions, is when our own precise spiritual theories tell us their precise limits, then there's no excuse to be dogmatic anymore. We know what the limit of that pointer is, exactly what the limit of that pointer is. Don't take the pointer any further than this, or you're off on bogus territory. So that's what I see happening with science and spirituality. And by the way, I'm not saying that scientists are less dogmatic than anybody else. Scientists are people. It's science as a scientific enterprise, as a social enterprise, where we pit theories against each other and demand precision and demand experimental. That social enterprise is anti-dogmatic. It counters the innate dogmatism that most of us harbor.
Yes, right? Very well said. Yeah.
So that's what I see going forward. And ultimately, then, when we have these precise theories, then we can make spiritual progress in understanding better and better pointers. Because I think we're limited by our teachers. How good can they teach? What kind of pointers can they give us to help us move along in the spiritual path? Well, if their pointers are 3,000 years old and they haven't really evolved, maybe we can do better than that. Maybe we can come up with pointers that evolve. Wouldn't it be nice to have spiritual traditions where we were reading what was discovered last week that sort of transcends everything that we've been doing for the last few centuries? And every week, you go to church and you're learning the new discoveries in spirituality and new ways to go deeper. That would be incredible. Instead of saying this is 2,000 years old or 3,000 years old, it must be true. No, it's 2,000 years old, 3,000 years old. Why haven't we made any more progress?
I guess the difficulty in you explaining just how much work it takes to be able to even understand some of this language, I think, is part of the hurdle here. It's wonderfully precise and wonderfully difficult, therefore.
It is, and that's why ultimately I would see that the genuine spiritual leaders would be the group that could really understand this and then translate it into everyday language. that everybody could use. Just like no one understands all the theoretical physics that goes into an iPhone, but someone translated it into an iPhone and you're happy to use the iPhone.
Yeah.
Very happy to use it.
What about the everyday? I mean, I think the religious, kind of the spiritual potential of this worldview, if it holds as well as it has held so far, at least as a possible worldview. I don't want to say that we've not proven that, but certainly there is a sense in which room has been made within science for this worldview of yours, and the spiritual, religious, divine, cosmic implications, I think, are for everyone to explore themselves, but it's pretty clear what kind of things one might find. What about every day? I have heard you say that thinking about this has made you feel like a lot of the things that we are really attached to is kind of, well, why be attached? You know, why would you be so attached to your car or whatever if it's just part of the headset? It's not part of the fundamental reality. I see the argument, but I would say that I'm partially unconvinced, because let's take selfishness aside. So let's think about me seeing a person, homeless person, doesn't have a home, doesn't have a car, isn't able to go see their dying parent because they don't have a mode of transportation, and they sleep in the rain. Well, I might really want to create a world where this person has a shelter and a mode of transportation. And I would be really, really quite mad if I work for that and then somebody just steals it off from this poor person. And I don't know if at that moment I would really be touched by an argument. Oh, don't worry, the car was just part of the headset. It's not part of the fundamental reality. Yes, but this person cannot go see their dying parent or whatever, you know. Like, so although I'm not saying there isn't something there, but I do you hear the concern I have? Is that it, in a way, I mean, the selfishness maybe is the problem more than attachment to objects, or maybe attachment in some ways of understanding is the problem. But yeah, where does this way of looking at reality then start making a difference? Because it seems that material things, as far as they are tools for genuinely valuable goals, it doesn't really take value away from them. So what changes?
Well, in this interpretation in which there is this just one fundamental consciousness, and you and I are just avatars, different avatars that one consciousness is wearing, then the religious dictum, love your neighbor as yourself, makes sense, because your neighbor is yourself. That is you in a different headset. And that really is what true love is to recognize the other as not someone that you have to try to figure out how you might love this, but to realize, no, that's me. That is me just in a different avatar. That's it. And so is my cat. And so is a mouse, and so is everything. It's me. So love your neighbor as yourself, because your neighbor is yourself. And if we really understand, I mean, that's either true or false. If it's true, it's the most profound truth that there is. And I think it is likely true. And we know as well that everything that you collect, all the goodies you collect in this world, disappear. You get a house, you get a mansion, you get a car, you get a reputation, you get your PhD. And where does it go? You walk away from all. You walk away from all of it. We know that there's nothing that you do here that you keep. None. Nothing. So those are the facts. That nothing. And I can't even tell you, you know, who my great-great-grandparents were. Don't know their names. You probably can't either.
So great grandparents. Yeah. Only one, actually. Yeah.
And there were, you know, 16 or 32 of them were, and I can't name one of them. So when you ask what's the point and what is the meaning of life? Well, it certainly isn't collecting stuff, because You walk away from all that stuff. And, but it, my guess is that the one consciousness puts on different headsets and explores its potential. That's the way the one learns about itself, is by trying on. And this is, we just happen to be in one of the cheaper headsets that the one has tried on. This is one of the cheaper ones, but it tries on countless other headsets. This is a trivial one, and explores the potentials in these various different headsets. And that's how it knows itself. There's some spiritual traditions that say that the formless can only know itself in contrast to forms. So plunge yourself into a world of forms, and then immerse yourself in it, identify with the forms, and then when you finally wake up and realize you're not that form, that's when you really understand who you are as the formless. And that may be, if I had to guess what life is about, that's what I would say, is we're here, we get plunged in, we completely identify with our careers and our jobs and collecting all this stuff and doing all this stuff and being important and so forth. And then all of a sudden we begin to realize, oh, wait a minute, I'm going to walk away from all this stuff. And no one's going to care about my career. No one's going to even, my great-great-grandkids won't even remember my name. So what's really going on here? What is this about? Well, it's not about getting stuff. It's not about being famous. It's not about, none of that stuff matters. It literally doesn't matter. And yet we spend our entire lives up to, some of us, all of our lives until we die. Yeah. And some of us, most of our lives until we start to go, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense.
And so the reason I wanted to give that example earlier is that I've kind of come to think that when people say don't get attached to material things, part of it is, of course, that any attachment is going to bring tears one day. You know, I think love is such a beautiful form of attachment that I'm happy crying. Right. Attachment to a watch is not maybe worth it. But I guess sometimes I feel the arguments to be a bit cheap, because I know that there are people who get bigger houses just because of status. But I also, none of my friends even has a guest room where they could host their parents. And I live in central London, and there's all sorts of inconveniences that can become genuine inconveniences if you have insomnia. And so my friends who are moving, I don't see any of them moving for status reasons. They move for genuine reasons that anybody who cares for them would want to succeed. And so maybe it's not the fact that we want stuff as such, because sometimes stuff is good, like a shelter is good for you if you're sleeping in the rain, but it's when we want stuff in a way that comes from a place of competition, conflict.
Right. Wanting to be special.
Yes, instead of the kind of place where, as I would want it for anyone, I want a shelter for myself too, but I don't want it so that others wouldn't have as big of a shelter as me.
Right, and this is again what the spiritual traditions talk about. They say that there's this fundamental illusion. You think of yourself as a small object in space-time. That's what I am. I'm this 150-pound, 200-pound, whatever it might be, little object in space-time, and I need to... I'm only going to be here for a few years, and I need to do whatever I can to try to complete myself and be special. And I need to compete with you. You're trying to be special and complete yourself. And that's the illusion. And the reason it's a problem is because it's an illusion. It's false. In fact, on the spiritual view, you are infinite intelligence. You are the author of everything that you're seeing. You are. You're not some little 150-pound thing inside of space-time.
Yeah. It's not you contrasted to that other.
That's right. And there's no need to be special. When you realize that this whole thing is me looking at myself. When I look at a rock, I'm looking at myself through a headset. That's what I'm seeing. When I look at you, I'm seeing myself. I'm seeing another avatar of myself looking at me back. And so from that point of view, then this is about plunging yourself into the headset and losing yourself in the headset, and then waking up and recognizing, no, I am the actual reality behind the entire headset. And that's what I am. And there's no need for me to be special or compete with anybody else because the other is me. I love my neighbor as myself because the other is myself. So the issue is not about a moral thing so much as just waking up from an illusion. Thinking yourself as a small, insignificant thing that needs to get special somehow and need to be more special than all these other people. And waking up and realizing, wait. I am more special than I could be in my wildest egoic dreams. I'm far more so special that you just have to laugh about all the egoic dreams of being the richest person on earth or the smartest person or the next time. All those, they're paltry compared to what you already are. And so but there's some deep humility in which the one infinite intelligence plunges itself down, loses itself, and then painfully wakes itself up. But that seems to be a necessary part of self understanding and self-knowledge. That's how the infinite knows itself, is by putting on different headsets and losing itself in the headsets and then waking up. This is not science. Yeah. This is me talking outside my expertise, but you asked the question. So I want to say, when I talk about projecting into decorated permutations in space time, that's science, and that's this other stuff. Take it with a grain of salt.
I always finish by asking guests about how the research they do has impacted their view on our species, on humanity. And I guess you can kind of take that to any direction you want. Starting to think about vision in a radical way, all the way to being, holy moly, this actually might explain particle physics, whatever that exactly means. How was it shaped, the way you look at this bipedal ape?
Well, before I used to be naturally quite judgmental about people and about myself. And now I'm recognizing that judgmentalism is just an illusion again on my part. If really it is the case that there is the one consciousness that's just putting on all these different headsets, and I'm seeing it as a person that robbed me, I've been robbed and so forth. That you can see it's a very different attitude toward the human being. It's not me judging people about their moral character and so forth. It's me saying, I used to do that. And it's still my emotional reaction, by the way. That's my emotions are that way. But now I'm looking at those emotions. I guess that I can look at those knee-jerk reactions of judgmentalism and so forth and recognize them as much as an illusion as my knee-jerk reaction that the moon really is there. When, my belief that the moon is there when no one looks. That's how I feel about it, because I feel I'm lost in the headset a lot of the time. But when I awake again, when I'm aware, then I realize there's no more reason for me to be judgmental about people than there is for me to believe the moon is there when I don't look. They're both an illusion. What's really there is me trying on various headsets and looking at what I do. So put it this way. Suppose you're playing a virtual reality game and you put on your headset and bodysuit and get in there. There's two ways you can play that game. One is, this is just a game and I'm having fun. And so I'm having fun. So I'm going to go rob a bank. Or it's me in the game and I don't know it's a game. I think it's the reality. Now all of a sudden it's very serious. Very, very serious. I get upset about things and I get judgmental about people and so forth.
Oh, would you go rob a bank now?
Well, I on either view, I don't recommend robbing the bank. So I'm not arguing for a moral behavior. But on the other hand, ultimately, I think when we take off the headset, we're going to realize that no one was really hurt. It was just a headset, right?
Tension then between the two ways you can take it, where one is a kind of more jubilant but perhaps more amoral direction. You know, at the end of the day, it's not that big of a deal. And then there is the other one, which you suggested earlier, which is that my neighbor is me. Therefore, why would I ever hurt them? Do you think that those are two alternative directions and everybody can kind of, it's like a buffet table, you pick your favorites, or are they somehow weaved to each other? Is there less tension than I see between them?
Well, I would say that probably we're here to wake up. That's what we're here. And so that's why I don't recommend amoral behavior, because perseverating in amoral behavior is perseverating in being asleep. And the point is to wake up to the fact that I'm here to love my neighbor as myself, because my neighbor is myself, to wake up to that whole thing and to wake up to the joy of love and to wake up to the fact that I don't need to be special. I don't need to be more special than anybody else. I am that other person, and I am the dog, and I am the cat. So I'm saying that ultimately the point of it, the morality, is not because cars are so important or that bank accounts are so important or that houses are so important. What's important is waking up. So you can see it's just not at all supporting amoral behavior, but it's actually being very forgiving and ultimately recognizing that in this realm, nothing is lost. Ultimately, my guess is we're going to all take off the headset and laugh.
So we laugh in an atemporal time, whatever that means.
Well, actually, it turns out we can have dynamics. You might say dynamics without time. Yes, dynamics without an arrow of time, no increasing entropy. But when you project that dynamics, the projection that loses information will force an arrow of time. So the arrow of time that we experience in this headset is entirely an artifact of loss of information in the projection. The original dynamics has no increasing entropy. So that's how you can actually have a dynamics without an arrow of time.
So that underlying reality is not going from order to chaos.
No. It's already complete.
Professor Donald Hoffman, thank you so much for your research and your incredibly generous time today.
My pleasure. Thanks so much, Ilari.
So that was it for today. I hope that you enjoyed it. If you did, please do consider supporting my work, first by subscribing to the podcast if you have not done so yet, and also by becoming a Patreon member at patreon.com/onhumans. Do also check out the On Humans newsletter at onhumans.substack.com, where you can read breakdowns and analysis of each episode. That can be a great way also to just refreshing your memory if there's an episode that you really liked but start forgetting what exactly was it about. Anyway, until next time, take care.